Good morning. It's Friday, May 15th, and you've tuned into North Idaho News of the Week. I'm Jack Peterson. Chris Bessler out today, and I'll tell you where he is in just a minute. But not to worry, we are not alone in the studio. Sansare Mitchell is here. Hi, Sansare.
Hello.
You are the senior writer for the Sandpoint Reader. And do you have another title? I feel like maybe you do, but maybe not. So that's how you're credited.
That's my credit.
On the masthead.
Co-owner.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's put that on the resume.
Mm-hmm.
We are here on the Lost in the 50s weekend. How about that? Today we are kicking off Lost in the 50s weekend in style by delivering you some news of the week. And I will start with, a couple of old news items that, Sansare, I'm warning you right now that I want to ask you about, because we didn't talk about it beforehand. Hopefully we have time to talk about what's going on at the Panhandle Health District. We talked about this last week a little bit, but preparing for fiscal year 2027, the health district in Bonner County are somewhat at odds over the budget, and negotiations are ongoing. Bonner County seeks to reduce its contribution to the health district unless certain clinical and policy changes are met. They are seeking more clinic days in Bonner County. Big news in Lake Ponderay water level. The surface of the lake is currently observed at 2,057.5 feet at Hope, which is up from last week and is rising rather dramatically now. Coming up by, I think it's coming up by like a couple inches a day. Does that seem crazy? That might be crazy. Might be more like a couple inches a week. No, I think I have that right. The Army Corps of Engineers addressed questions about Lake Ponderay's water level and the repairs to Albany Falls Dam at a May 7th meeting. And I'm going to read from the Sandpoint Reader this article by Ben Olson, who attended that meeting. Talking about the spring refill of Lake Ponderay, as well as the repairs to the Albany Falls Dam. Seattle District Commander Colonel Kate Sanborn, who is scheduled for redeployment and will no longer be a name that we're seeing in our paper quite as often, I expect, is saying that on the downstream side of Albany Falls Dam, it will mostly look like normal operations as it has the last several years. The lake level should reach 2,060 feet by the end of May and summer pool of 2,062 feet by Friday, June 19th, just in time for Father's Day. It is indeed several inches per day coming up, so it is coming up fast. She goes on to say, if we can do it sooner, we will. The spillway gate replacement project is ongoing. This is repairs to defects that were found in 2024. And they pulled spillway gate number 3 after they found the defects when they pulled gate number 3 for routine inspection the year before, and the concerns were such that should a gate could fail unexpectedly and immediately and lead to altogether a complete failure of the gate, which would mean a major loss of control to the water flowing through the dam and to the lake level. And the way it would happen during times that the steel gates are moved open or closed, and that led to restricted operations for the past couple of seasons. Colonel Sanborn says, quote, "The good news is that gate number 3 is back in the project thanks to fiber reinforced polymer rehabilitation," unquote. And the rehabbed gate has added sensors and can be moved differently than the other gates, giving the Corps added control. Well, so there we have it. Coming up to 2,060 feet is the lake by the end of May, and summer pool of 2,062 feet by the middle of June. It does sound like they are, the article goes on to state that even though that obviously lots of people in our area are concerned that this refill is happening slower than usual, and that's going to have an economic impact as well as just a, you know, quality of life impact. But that it's concerns about the amount of water remaining in the system, mostly to the east in Montana, which is where the water or the source of the water that ends up in Lake Pend'Oreille is. So even though around here we look in the mountains and don't see a great deal of snowpack, there does remain quite a bit still in western Montana, and a sudden rain on snow event could bring such a deluge that the lake is indeed still at risk of flooding if such a thing were to happen. That's a good summary, I think, of the meeting on May 7th and that nice article by Mr. Olson in this week's Reader. The Long Bridge, the walking path, is currently closed. The Long Bridge over Lake Pend'Oreille, connecting Sandpoint to the Sagal Peninsula. I guess it's technically over the river, isn't it? Or people have varying opinions on that. It depends on what map you're looking at. But the pedestrian section is partially closed, but it is open to pedestrian use, and you can currently cross all the way from one side to another, so use it as normally. There are sections of it that are closed for repairs. I think routine inspection of the lake revealed some crumbling support structures on the outside of the beams in some areas, and those can be repaired without closing the bridge as a whole, although it is difficult because that is a pedestrian bridge and you can't drive a truck on it. So they're going to be doing some work from boats and they're using drones to observe what's going on underneath, where they can't drive a truck and just hang workers over the side to observe and repair. There is a slight update to this story, which is that safety measures on the Long Bridge are repeatedly being vandalized during this period of closure, partial closure. The Idaho Transportation Department has said that they could be forced to shut down pedestrian access until repairs are complete. The public information officer for ITD, Heather McDaniel, said that crews have already had to reestablish blockades 3 times since they were installed just last Friday. Quote, "Staying anywhere outside of those restricted areas means it's perfectly safe for everyone to keep using the bridge. That's the concerning part, is that we've got people that are going out there and intentionally taking down that traffic control. Obviously, they're jeopardizing not only their own safety, but that of everybody else." So leave those traffic cones in place, please and thank you, says the Idaho Transportation Department, or else they will be forced to close the bridge entirely. But right now, that pedestrian bridge is still open, and you can walk or ride your bicycle all the way across north to south. In other traffic-related news, the same Idaho Transportation Department has said that they're going to restripe the intersection of Lakeshore Drive and Highway 95, and they will be eliminating the northbound turn option onto 95 from Lakeshore Drive, and that will hopefully relieve some of the traffic accidents that are prone to occur there when people try to cross over the southbound traffic to turn north. There's a J turn that they can use to the south, and that is the recommended route, so that that will no longer even be a legal option to turn left onto 95 from Lakeshore Drive after the restriping project is complete. And in Sandpoint, Pine Street has reopened between Boyer and Division, directly impacting your life, I imagine, Sansaray.
Absolutely.
Mine as well. Yes. And they opened, I believe, ahead of schedule. I think that the aforementioned Mr. Olson had a bouquet in his bouquet and Barb's column saying that they did a nice and quick job. I think they were scheduled to be finished this week, but they opened up like last Friday. They mm-hmm. they really opened that up, and that major thoroughfare, that major east-west traffic conduit is open and is just smooth as butter. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also the Public Works Department has restriped streets throughout town. So all the streets are nice and painted. All of this work being done just in time for Lost in the 50s weekend. That's news from the city of Sandpoint. Out in Ponderay, Avista Power has applied for a special use permit to build a complex near the intersection of East Bronx Road and US 95. There is a public hearing on May 18th. That's next Monday at Ponderay City Hall, 5:30 p.m. To receive the public's feedback about this. And Sansaray Mitchell has the story in the B. And let's start there. There's a
in
few
the
other.
Reader.
Oh, in the that's what I said. That's what I said. The reader. in the reader. Yes. I have a couple more news items that we'll get to if there's time towards the end of the show. But let's get started here because this was a long section of headlines this morning. Avista. Yes. What are they? What are they intending to build, or what are they asking for permission to build from the city of Ponderay and its residents on Bronx Road and Highway 95? And why?
And why? Well,
yes.
For everyone who lives here and goes through Ponderay, you can see that that's a booming town. It's mm-hmm. it's growing pretty rapidly. And Avista's actually in their application cites that between 2020 and 2023, the area's population increased by 15.8%. And so more people, more businesses, especially more industrial businesses, means they need more power out there. And so they want to build a 6-acre substation, which is essentially it's going to take the high voltage electricity from the grid and lower the voltage and redistribute it to the surrounding areas so that everybody can get power. And what that's going to do is it's going to make it so that the substation is closer to the area it's serving. And so when we have like power outages and things that are down, they can repair that a lot faster. And also it'll be more localized. So one substation is going to take out Sandpoint and Ponderay and the outlying area. It's also going to serve as a place for personnel, for storage, for easy access for workers to go to and from fixing issues and establishing power lines to new buildings and things like that. As part of their 10-year plan, they also want to build a large office building right next door that would just have people there to help with billing and customer support, account management, and general operations. So that would be a really easy, accessible place for the public to actually go in and talk to Avista representatives rather than, like I have historically, just being on the phone with mostly a robot for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of a 10-year plan if it gets approved. So initially, they will just build essentially half of the 6-acre substation. And the 22-acre parcel that they're building this on that they bought in 2018 is going to be left mostly as just grazing pasture for area cattle. So they're going to fence off all the dangerous bits and let the grass and everything still continue to grow and feed our local animals. They have a lot of other plans to sort of help this facility not be an eyesore and blend into the local area. Of course, out on East Bronx Road, that's already a semi-residential, semi-industrial. It's got an existing power station out there owned by Northern Lights that's significantly smaller. And so in order to blend everything, they're going to put up a large soundproof, essentially a combination of a wall and a fence that's sort of brown that blends into the background and will cut down on any noise created by the power station. There isn't really expected to be a lot of noise or pollution, light pollution. They noted in their application that there will be no smell, so that's good. They're also going to do a fair bit of landscaping to put up a vegetation, local evergreen and deciduous trees to sort of block views from residential areas, put up some nice boulders and things. So they've integrated a lot of different design choices, I would say, that are going to help this not stick out like a big metal behemoth in the middle of an otherwise beautiful little area of pasture land. And so their goal is essentially to help with power redistribution in the area while not affecting adversely the people who live there.
Okay. Substation, not a power generation station. So yes. No smokestacks, no anything. This is one of those kind of, it's an array of tall metal poles and wires, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that you see around from time to time, but it's not overly noisy or anything, I guess. It's just, making it blend into the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you see anybody pushing back on this? Anybody saying, Avista, you should not do this? Or is this all kind of well thought out and well approved, pre-approved public utility complex?
It appears to be pretty well thought out at this point. We'll see if they get more public comments at the hearing this Monday.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, it suits the area that it's in. It's matches with existing infrastructure and businesses and things. So I haven't seen a lot of opposition. There's always someone, especially with people who are concerned about waves and electromagnetics and things like that,
mm-hmm.
Which I can't explain, but there's a lot of people who are concerned about it.
Sure.
And they know things, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah. You want to make sure that they're doing it safely. So we'll see what the public comment is like, but that's at this point probably expected to begin construction at some point soon.
Probably. It was unanimously approved by the Planning and Zoning Commission. So this is a secondary and final approval.
Yes. The Sandpoint Reader last week had a great article under your byline on the fire and flood mitigation efforts out in Clark Fork. There was I'm going to pull it up on my computer here so I know whereof I speak, but I know that there's concerns that you illustrated very well about just sort of it's egress and access is the point of concern. And it looks like, if I read correctly, that at least there is generally safe egress. People can get away from their property, hopefully, in time to avoid disaster, to their person if a fire is approaching. But that's a one-way road I mean, if in in the conditions of an emergency, they can hopefully get out, but that traffic will be flowing in one direction, and having actual like crews, having trucks go to a property to prevent the spread of fire, to fight a fire, is it's a major concern. It's a major danger for the upcoming fire season, and future ones. And this is going to be a hot, dry summer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, according to the forecast. Did I summarize that about correctly?
Absolutely.
And yeah. What? Anything more? Is there more to be said there? I know. I mean, there's a private exit road, right?
Yes.
And it's only open like in case of emergency. Is mm-hmm. that's the story?
Mm-hmm.
And people can't. So that's how people can get out. But it's not a maintained county road or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So for a little bit more context, the Highlands and Liberty Heights developments up in Clark Fork are sort of back in the hills, and they have quite a few residents that have lived there for a number of years, and they are really they're up above Spring Creek and Lightning Creek, and so there's this kind of ravine that goes up to them, and so they are in a very dangerous spot generally, mm-hmm. because if a fire starts below there, the winds are going to take it up that valley and up to their homes. And the issue is you kind of got to go through that valley to get out in case of a fire. And so this has been an issue for something like a decade. And one of the area residents, Iris DeMero, who you might know her as the person who builds all of those geodesic domes out in Clark Fork.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. She owns quite a bit of property up there, and mm-hmm. she has been concerned about egress and ingress because there was filed with the county a official road that went through her property, and a few years back she had to go to the county and say, "I know that this is marked on the maps and that you have a legal right-of-way, but I'm here to tell you that that road fell into the creek about 5 years ago or so. And so you can map it and say that there's a way to get out, but there isn't. People can't drive down that."
Mm-hmm.
And so she asked the county to vacate that right-of-way, and they said, "Yes, we can do that, considering it doesn't exist. But there still needs to be some kind of egress." And so she created Fireweed Lane, which is that small one-lane road that you were talking about. And it's a bit of a precarious placement. It's the best that she could do, mm-hmm. but it is right next to Spring Creek. It has lots of different dips and bumps and cliff faces. You can't really widen it because it's already backed up as far as it can between creeks and cliffs. And so it's a good road in case of emergency. And so she has an agreement with the county that blocks off that road unless the Bonner County commissioners declare a state of emergency, and then local firefighters or EMS or anyone can go in and unlock the gates, blocking it off, move the pilings and things, and then open that road up. And so, like you said, people can really only get out using that. And the first time it was used was just in January or December, rather, when we had all of that flooding down here and also up in Clark Fork. And so that was really an unforeseen circumstance. They'd never anticipated floods. This was Fireweed Lane for forest fires, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so the road was used successfully to get people out, but it washed out almost immediately afterwards. And so no one could get back up into those properties. Everybody was stranded downstream. And so Iris and with the help of the local fire department, called a big public meeting to discuss alternative routes to figure out if they can improve the road at all. And those two things are they seem like small issues, and yet they are not. They're pretty massive because, of course, it costs a lot of money to build roads. It's in a difficult placement. And they were researching essentially all of the old Forestry Service roads, pioneer trails, trails that people have just cut for their horses, trying to find some means of alternative egress in and out of the mountains there, and maybe going up and over the ridges into Hope as opposed to back down along the creeks. And pretty much every place they suggested by going on to, you know, essentially Google Earth and looking around with the satellites, area residents said, you know, oh, well, there's a cliff there, which is not shown up on the map, so you can't go up there. Or, oh, there's an underground water source here, and so you can't build a road on top of that. And so the meeting went on for quite a few hours, and local residents essentially said no to every single idea. And at the end of it, they said, okay, you know, we got to go home, so we'll form a little committee amongst ourselves, and we'll work to find a place for the new road and work on improving the existing road with our own time, money, and effort. And so most people volunteered their tractors or their extra gravel or things like that to try and fix things up.
Yeah. So they're trying to fix up the existing Spring Creek Lane. The existing Fireweed Lane.
Fireweed Lane, because of Iris's agreement with the county, the county comes in and fixes the road after every emergency use, which they've only had one in its history.
Yeah.
But they don't have any obligation to improve the road. So they're hoping to improve that one to make it sturdier in case of flood again, and then also improve East Spring Creek Road, which is the main access point, which flooded out back in December, and then potentially create a new third road that would be accessible all the time. And also, rather than, like Fireweed Lane does, run parallel to the existing road and so encounter the same issues, this one would go in a different direction, hopefully. And that'll also help area residents because, as it stands right now, tree falls down or down power lines, anything like that, everyone is stuck there because that's not technically a state of emergency, so they can't use Fireweed Lane.
Yeah. Well, this is not great news. it doesn't sound like this problem is solved or is really approaching a true solution. I mean, it could yet be a disaster if a fast moving forest fire or another flood, you know, impacts the area.
Yeah. It seems like, it stands right now, the road will barely work for any kind of emergency. And if we have a massive rain on snow events and get more flooding, then that could be yet again.
It's prone to wash out. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
It could happen again. Yeah. Well, it is basically our time, already, but since you're here, Sansere, would you like to try your hand at explaining, what's going on in the Panhandle Health District and their kind of budgetary negotiations with Bonner County? The Panhandle Health District, I'll try to just provide a little context here. The Panhandle Health District is not, it represents not just Bonner County. It's the Panhandle Health District. It covers the whole Panhandle, the five northern counties, Benoit, Bonner, Boundary, Kootenai and Shoshone. And so that health district doesn't just, it serves this whole area, and the counties pay into the Panhandle Health District and receive services in exchange, I suppose. And Bonner County is, in Bonner County and Panhandle Health District are not seeing quite eye to eye on that, on the funds paid to services received ratio, I guess.
Yes, Bonner County has been the leading negotiator for the counties. They've already reduced the budget significantly in the last few years, and now new directors and a new Panhandle Board of Health have come in and are trying to restructure the clinics so that they're going to get more use from people and by extension get more revenue to become more self-sustaining. But there has been an issue with the Bonner County commissioners and different levels trying to negotiate and sort of refusing to pay, even though we have to pay by state statute. But Commissioner Brian Domke says that essentially this is socialism, and so he doesn't personally support it. Asia Williams does not like the 2% cost of living increases that they have baked in for their doctors and nurses and things like that. And Commissioner Ron Korn, who is the most vocal and sort of the one that's at all of the meetings, is really pushing for what he calls informed consent, especially for vaccines, which he wants to see a policy in place that gives more information from various sources about what are the ingredients in the vaccine and what are the possible side effects and things like that. And so Panhandle Health District already does this with information from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But Ron Korn says that the CDC is all liars. So we can't trust that information. And so they want it from a secondary source. And he very openly said, if you don't do this, I'm not voting to fund you. So,
but I mean, by, as you just said, by state, I mean, the rule is pretty clear that ultimately the Bonner County will have to pay their share of the bill. They can't opt out of the health district, for example.
They have to give something.
Yeah.
But Korn could absolutely cause a stink and you know, refuse to vote for anything and keep trying to whittle away at the budget unless they do this. And the health district is handling this very well. They've gone on record and said, we want everyone to know that we are practicing informed consent. All of our nurses and doctors and everyone will talk about the potential risks of anything that they are administering. But they will, to better serve the public and to help with Commissioner Korn's concerns, they're going to put a policy in place that says, you know, we have to do steps 1 through 5. And that way there's sort of a written record of proof that they are practicing informed consent.
Okay. The health district has a clinic. You write in your article here that their headquarters is in Hayden, down south, south of here, that is, but not relatively central, I guess, in the health district. They have a clinic in Hayden that's open 5 days a week. They are once a week. They have a clinic here in Sandpoint. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing this is at that building out on Pine and what, no, Cross Street, I guess. near the end of Pine, or near the end of the city limits on Pine Street. And then they divide their services once a week between Kellogg and St. Mary's. The Bonner County commissioners argued that Bonner County is not receiving enough clinic days as well. Are they asking for that to be a twice a week clinic?
Least twice a week. They're asking for more mental health services and more general clinic days. And
and Who, by the way, uses that clinic? I mean, do you know? You may not know. This isn't in your article, but like, who is this? This is a walk-in clinic. Is this a clinic of last resort, or who goes to the Panhandle Health District clinic?
I know I've used it quite a few times.
Okay.
It's not just for people who, you know, can't afford to pay, though that is one of its main goals, is to sort of fill the coverage gap of people who are struggling with insurance. But it's used primarily by women in all of the five northern counties to do things like family planning, women's health, general things like that. And then they deliver a lot of vaccines. And so one of the arguments for increasing clinic days up here is it goes along with the restructurings of the Panhandle Health District clinic as a whole. And so Sandpoint wants more mental health resources, more just general health help with like diet and exercise recommendations. So they want, you know, dietitians, really a holistic view of health. So it's not just, you know, oh, my kid's got to get measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. We got to go there. So they want to diversify what they're offering and then be here more often. And part of that was because years ago, we used to have more clinic days, and then Panhandle Health District kept losing staff because Idaho really isn't very competitive in the medical world in terms of salaries and benefits and things like that. So all of our doctors and nurses moved to Washington, and then eventually you don't have anybody to staff the clinic, so you have to reduce your days of operation. And we definitely need more clinic days in Bonner County to serve our population, because our population is going down to Hayden and going down to Kootenai County. And then also, they used to have clinic days up in Boundary County in Bonner's Ferry, and now all of those people are coming into Sandpoint.
Interesting. Okay. How does Boundary County feel about this? Are they asking for anything more, or is this conflict is, or this is mainly a Bonner County issue?
It's mainly a Bonner County issue. I mean, if we've had some sort of conservative pushback from our commissioners, so you can imagine up in Boundary County, which is even more deeply conservative.
Usually, perceived as more conservative.
Anyway. So they are, they don't want to spend more money, but they're also not necessarily going to push for these kinds of things.
Right. Well, let's see. It's well past our time. It'll be, I guess, to close out that segment of the show, is there, you know, what happens next at the Panhandle Health District and Bonner, the Bonner County Central Committee, or the Board of County Commissioners?
So all of the commissioners from the five northern counties are going to meet with Panhandle Health District and actually go through the budget together and vote to approve, to deny, to change. And so that's been difficult for them to schedule, because that's a lot of moving parts and a lot of people from different counties.
Yeah.
But that will be the next step for them.
Okay. I'm flipping through my reader here, looking for that, that there was, I think, a helpful guide somewhere in here to voting, but it's, coming up on election day. This is the last news, of the week that we'll have before the election, which is on Tuesday, May 19th.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you are not currently registered to vote, you can register to vote on election day at your polling place. You can find information about that at, if you're an internet user, Idaho Votes. Ah, there we go. It was right there on the front page and I didn't even see it. Information about that on, I believe it's voteidaho.gov. Has all sorts of information. You can kind of just enter your name and your birthday and see if you're registered to vote, and if so, you know, where your polling place is. All absentee ballots must, if you're an absentee voter, they must be returned to the elections office That is to say, they can't be put in the mail on election day. They must be returned to the elections office by 8 p.m. on election day. And let's see. Yes, you, as I just mentioned, you can still register at the polls. You cannot change your party affiliation if you are affiliated with a party. But if you are not affiliated or if you're not yet registered, you are able to select a party affiliation at the polls. The Idaho Republican primary, which is the heavily contested, in fact, the only really contested primary in our area, is closed to only those who are registered as Republicans, as party members. On the other hand, the Idaho Democratic Party is open to all registered voters, regardless of affiliation. You can also, I think, register as a member of the Constitution Party and the Libertarian Party if you want, without any candidates to vote for in this this round of elections. But you can still register to vote on election day, and if you are not registered with a party already, you can register as a member of the party of your choice and vote in the election of your choice. You do have to register as a member of that party. You can't register as unaffiliated and expect to receive a ballot that has candidates' names on it, basically. There are a few other elections that everybody will be able to vote for, regardless of party affiliation. There's a judicial race, and there are some levy elections as well, and that's going to be a busy day. On Tuesday, May 19th, polls close at 8 p.m. here on 88.5 KRFY. We'll be just wrapping up the little live radio hour at 8 o'clock, and I think once we start seeing results, you can expect to hear us broadcast them here, but that's usually a late night. So that I wouldn't expect to hear final results. Well, midterm election, I don't know, but probably still not before 10, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Jason Saray is nodding at me, 10. But I'll at least stay down here at the station until 10 or 11 o'clock and see if we have results. And if we do by then, I will broadcast them. You can listen to all of our candidate interviews as well as the two candidate forums on our website, KRFY.org. Of course, the Reader, as well as the Daily Bee, have been covering these local elections extensively as well. You had a questionnaire 2 weeks ago, I think, the candidate questionnaire. So lots of divisions within the Republican primary. That's going to be interesting to see what happens. And I guess that's it. Sansare, are you excited for Lost in the 50s?
Oh, yeah. This is my first time being a townie, so
hey,
it's going to come pretty much next to my house.
Oh, cool. Are you going to be at home? You're going to just look out your window and watch it go by? Or are you going to go out and sit on a lawn chair?
Oh, I used to do all the dress up and the lawn chairs, but that was for a younger me.
Okay. Well, the parade tonight is at, hold on, the car parade. I know there's details here in the Reader. I saw it. The car parade goes by tonight at 6 p.m., and it begins at Sandpoint High School and travels down Cedar Street to Division Avenue, Church Street, and then finally down First Avenue. I will probably be right out in front of the radio station because I can just take chairs from the radio station, go right out the front door onto First Avenue, and set them there, and it's like I'm prepared or something. So there you have it. That's tonight, and then, of course, the car show downtown tomorrow will shut down traffic on 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Avenues, and the cars will be parked out and open to foot traffic. You can go and check out your favorite old-time automobiles. And on besides the Tuesday report on the election, on Wednesday morning, tune in, and certainly Chris and I will be here. I don't know who else will be here to talk about the results of the election, and then we'll be back on Friday as well with further news and analysis. This was a long one, Sansare. Thanks for hanging out. I hope I haven't cut into your day by keeping you here an extra 15 minutes.
Not at all. I love it.
There's lots to talk about. Mm-hmm. Lots of county news. Okay. On now to Otto's Eclectic Mix, and thanks for listening to 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio. Thanks again, Sansaray Mitchell of the Sandpoint Reader.
Thank you.